This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 3rd, 2004. At Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Aller sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. Senator John Edwards bows out of the race as Senator John Kerry claims victory on Super Tuesday. Attacks in Iraq during a Shia Muslim holy day killed more than 200 yesterday. And we bring you on-the-ground coverage from Haiti. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Portland, Oregon, today, officials issued the state's first marriage licenses to same-gendered couples after county officials determined the state constitution required them to do so. In Georgia, a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage was defeated largely by the Black Caucus, legislators whose constituents largely support the measure. The amendment may come back as early as tomorrow. And in New York, lesbians and gays continue to tie the knot. Amma Boadi has more from New York City.
Newport's Mayor Jason West says he will plead innocent at his arraignment tonight on 19 counts of officiating marriages without a license. West could face up to a year in jail if found guilty. Mark Dunley, a member of the Green Party in New York State, told FSRN why Mayor West and his party have taken such action.
We certainly believe that New York State law and the Constitution gives the right for equal treatment for gays and lesbians. The Attorney General did indicate that he felt that gay marriages, in fact, should be legal. And in fact, it may be unconstitutional that the New York State law does not provide for same-sex marriage.
Carolyn K. Peterson, the mayor of Ithaca, hoped to force the issue into the courts by accepting marriage applications by same-gender couples and forwarding them to the state's Department of Health for a ruling on whether they could be granted. And in Nyack, Mayor John Shields says he will begin conducting gay marriages and plans to get a license himself to marry his partner. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Amma Boadi.
Former WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers has pleaded innocent to charges he committed one of the most massive corporate frauds in U.S. history. Ian Forrest reports from New York.
After months of exclusion from an ongoing investigation into the collapse of WorldCom MCI, Bernie Ebbers, that company's former CEO, has surrendered to authorities on charges of securities fraud, conspiracy to commit fraud, and participation in filing false corporate records with the Securities and Exchange Commission. For months, Scott Sullivan, WorldCom's former chief financial officer, denied any involvement by Ebbers in the events that brought one of the world's largest companies tumbling into bankruptcy. However, in a plea reached recently with the government, Sullivan pleaded guilty to 3 felony charges, 12 less than he was originally charged with, and agreed to cooperate with the authorities in their case against Ebbers. Ebbers exaggerated WorldCom earnings to the tune of $11 billion and laid off some 17,000 employees along the way. For FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
At least 45 people were killed and over 150 wounded yesterday when gunmen opened fire on a procession of Shiite Muslims in Quetta, the capital of Pakistan's southwestern Balochistan province bordering Afghanistan. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Mazrur Hussain reports from Islamabad.
Witnesses say first there was a bomb blast and then firing started from rooftop on hundreds of mourners passing through the city's commercial district. They were beating their chests in traditional commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, grandson of Prophet Muhammad. The majority of the victims are believed to be part of the Hazara Shiite community of Afghanistan who migrated to Pakistan as a result of persecution at the hands of Taliban. A government spokesman in Islamabad today blamed foreign hands for destabilizing the region. Troops have been called out to restore order and an indefinite curfew imposed in the city. The Quetta massacre took place within 2 hours of explosions in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad and another city, Karbala, that killed an estimated 182 Shiite pilgrims. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
And in a surprising turn of events, the Senate overwhelmingly rejected a measure to shield gun manufacturers and dealers from lawsuits yesterday. Rihanna Ortiz reports from Washington, D.C.
The bill had been predicted to pass with wide bipartisan support, but instead was easily defeated 90-8. The defeat came at the last minute after the National Rifle Association's powerful lobby withdrew support of the bill because of amendments that Democrats tacked on to the legislation. These included an assault weapons ban and mandatory background checks at gun shows. Rob Wilcox, the spokesman of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, is pleased that the NRA was forced to go against its own endorsement.
Well, Americans should be very happy that this bill was defeated, because what it would have done would have put the gun industry basically above the law and given it legal protections that no other industry in America enjoys.
Demonstrating the key role the issue of gun control will play this election year, John Kerry and John Edwards left the campaign trail to cast their first votes of the year, both in opposition to the bill. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Rihanna Ortiz.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
In what is being reported as the first action of foreign forces in Haiti to prevent further bloodshed, U.S. Marines blocked rebels from chasing officials of exiled leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide as they fled to the airport today. This as Guy Philippe's armed insurgents moved to consolidate their power in Haiti. In many cities, the self-proclaimed military is now the political leadership, too. And as FSRN's Cody Emmanuel and Deepa Fernandez report from the northern Haitian city of Cape Haitien, the extreme lack of food in rural Haiti is leading to a humanitarian disaster that both the new army and the international community seem indifferent to.
It's now been 4 days since the ouster of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and there is still no replacement government in many Haitian cities. Cape Haitien is awaiting the process in the capital Port-au-Prince to run its course, meaning there is no local government in place here in Cape Haitien. Self-declared Haitian military chief Marcel Daniels tells FSRN that Cape Haitien is essentially under his control.
I am responsible for Cape Haitien. I am responsible for providing security and disarming the Chimer. At this point, no other political decisions have been made. I've set up a committee to study all inquiries. I review them and respond to the ones which are our main priorities.
And while this military outfit certainly is in charge of security and policing issues, one sees Haitians dressed in army fatigues with patches that say U.S. Army clearly on their breast pockets around the streets of Cape Haitien. Human rights groups are left wondering when the escalating humanitarian crisis will be addressed and by whom.
When we say people are starving, we can say 50% of the rural area, especially in the northeast.
That is Nelta Jean-Louis, the national official for the UN's World Food Programme in the north of Haiti. She's watched the food crisis reaching alarming levels over the last few weeks and fears that the 50% starvation levels could grow. Jean-Louis talks about the crisis affecting especially rural Haiti.
But when you take a place like Dirac, Faitan, Paulette, and those people, they don't have crops. They depend on the agriculture, but now they don't receive food and they cannot do small business as they used to do, and because the Dominican board was closed, and they cannot even come in the big town, in the city, for the exchange. So they have nothing. Right now,
the UN's World Food Programme is currently without any food to supply the growing hunger needs, as their warehouse was ransacked and looted here in Cape Haitien on Sunday night, the day after the armed opposition took control of the country. In major Haitian cities, the situation is also worsening, but is not as grave as rural Haiti. At the Cape Haitien General Hospital, we speak to the head pediatrician, Mary Louis Charles, who tells us that the end of international aid to the Aristide government that once helped the hospital buy food and medicine has left them unable to treat many children.
We receive children who are suffering from malnutrition, but for some time we have not received that many patients. We used to offer food for the children, but since the international community cut off aid, many children do not come here because many times the parents have to pay for the food and medicine. As you know, many of the people here do not have that luxury.
From Cape Haitien for FSRN with Cody Emmanuel, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
On Capitol Hill today, the House International Relations Subcommittee held a hearing on the political situation in Haiti. Ms. Jezerich reports from D.C.
As Haitian rebel leader Guy Philippe declared himself chief of the Haitian army and police, spokesperson for the Department of State Richard Boucher indicated that the rebel forces will not be a part of a political solution. However, this does not mean the Bush administration opposed the overthrow of the democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, as Vice President Dick Cheney told CNN that he was pleased Aristide is gone. Cheney said Aristide was a corrupt leader who wore out his welcome in Haiti, but Aristide claims he was forced out by the U.S. The debate reached Capitol Hill on Wednesday as the House International Relations Subcommittee held a hearing on the situation in Haiti. Predictably, Republicans said Aristide was a corrupt leader who needed to go, while Democrats charged the Bush administration with assisting in the overthrow of Aristide. Representative William De La Hunt is a Democrat from Massachusetts.
Haiti did not have to be delivered into the hands of people who are, to put it in terms familiar to many of us, pure evil. But the fact is that the past 10 years, the majority in this Congress and the current administration did nothing to nurture democratic institutions in Haiti. Instead, aid was blocked.
And Representative Jerry Weller is a Republican from Illinois.
Under Aristide, Haiti blatantly became a hub of narcotics trafficking. Where is the outrage to the fact that Barry McCaffrey, President Clinton's own drug czar, said with regard to Aristide and his role in narco trafficking that, quote, "It's hard to imagine that Aristide himself isn't taking part in this enormously lucrative form of criminal activity." Makes one wonder why Aristide became very quickly Haiti's wealthiest man.
Testifying at the hearing was Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega. Aristide supporters say Noriega was a protege of former Senator Jesse Helms, who initiated the sanctions on Haiti in the mid-90s. Noriega says Aristide only has himself to blame and that now it will be the role of the international community to develop Haiti both governmentally and economically.
The Haitian people are not to blame for the country's poverty and lack of development. Those of us who have Haitian friends and colleagues know that they are an especially creative and particularly industrious people.
The International Republican Institute, which operates under the National Endowment for Democracy, has been spending $600,000 a year, funded by USAID, for political trainings to Haitians in the neighboring country of the Dominican Republic, where the rebels were also at. Critics say this is evidence that the U.S. helped finance the rebellion. So, what interest does the U.S. have in removing Aristide? Glenn Ford, the co-publisher of the online Black Commentator, says it's because Aristide undermined the economic goals of the U.S. foreign policy.
There are billions of dollars to be made in Haiti in the sweatshops that the upper class in Haiti wants to maintain. They're the interlocutors with the multinational corporations that want a total divestment of all state enterprises in Haiti. They want an invasion of U.S. capital, so their interests converge.
I'm Mitch Jezrich for Free Speech Radio News.
Yesterday evening, Venezuela's National Electoral Council finally announced the results of its verification of signatures in the petition for a recall referendum against President Hugo Chavez. The results of the verification, which make a recall referendum less likely, were anticipated already a week ago, which is why citizens opposed to President Chavez have been conducting violent demonstrations against the government for the past few days. Greg Wilpert reports from Caracas, Venezuela.
The opposition's efforts to organize a recall referendum received a setback yesterday when it was confirmed that petitions filled out with the same handwriting will require an additional certification by the signers, who have to personally confirm that they signed the forms. National Electoral Council President Francisco Carrasquero announced the final results.
Solicitudes bajo observación.
Total number of petitions processed from the universe of valid petition forms, 3,086,013 petitions. Petitions validated for the recall referendum, 1,832,493. Petitions under observation in need of being ratified via the repair process for constituting petitions or signatures written in similar handwriting, 876,017.
Electoral Council member Jorge Rodriguez explained the signature verification process.
When the citizen identification number is published, the categories will be identified of the signatures that were accepted, signatures that were rejected, and those signatures that require reconfirmation due to being part of the signatures written by the same handwriting. It should be completely clear that all signatures that were written by the same handwriting are subject to recertification process.
The opposition to Chavez, however, is crying foul. Opposition leaders have urged their followers to take to the streets. They are blocking roads and engaging in confrontations with the National Guard. The clashes have cost 9 lives throughout the country so far and many wounded. One opposition protester in a group of 10 at an intersection in a wealthy Caracas neighborhood explained her reasons for blocking the streets.
We did all the things they told us we had to do. And if we acted as they wanted us to do, how come we can't go to elections? We have the signatures, and now they're saying that we don't have them. So we have our signatures, so they have to respect that.
Sobeya Mejías, an opposition representative on the National Electoral Council, argued that requiring recertification of signatures that appeared to be written by one person violates the good faith and burden of proof requirements in Venezuelan law.
These policies were not provided for in any norms issued by the National Electoral Council and flagrantly violates the Constitution, and not to mention the principles of goodwill and good faith of the voter.
The entire recall referendum process is being observed by the Carter Center, whose representative, Jennifer McCoy, said the following shortly after the announcement of the verification process.
Our report says that our criteria are a little bit different from that chosen by the Electoral Council with regard to these signatures. In any case, this is a decision of the Electoral Council, and we respect their decision. Therefore, the two of us, the Organization of American States and the Carter Center, are very willing to continue to offer our services in order to facilitate dialogue and to wait until there is an agreement between the two sides.
Of the 2.4 million signatures required to activate a recall referendum, only 1.8 are valid so far. Another million or so have to be recertified in a two-day process at the end of the month. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
As projected, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry won big on Super Tuesday. What's billed as the biggest day of the Democratic primary election season brought us primaries and a caucus in 10 states, with 1,151 delegates up for grabs. While corporate media chose to focus on whether Senators Kerry and Edwards were getting along, across the country voters had other concerns in mind. FSRN's Gail Walker has more.
Tonight, the message could not be clearer. All across our country, change is coming to America.
That was Senator John Kerry speaking to supporters on Super Tuesday. Among early rumors that John Edwards would leave the presidential race today, Kerry swept Super Tuesday, winning in 9 states and grabbing 570 delegates, virtually cementing his position as the Democratic presidential nominee. Kerry lost only the state of Vermont to former Governor Howard Dean. Vermont was an unexpected win for Dean, given that the former frontrunner dropped out of the race 2 weeks ago. With Edwards' departure from the race, only Kerry, Representative Dennis Kucinich, and the Reverend Al Sharpton remain in the race for the Democratic nomination. But focusing on the front runners, Kucinich says there's not much of a difference between John Kerry and John Edwards, and that he represents the only real choice for the U.S. electorate.
You have to remember that Senator Edwards and Senator Kerry really didn't have that much of a difference of opinion on the war, on the Patriot Act, on trade, on health care, and a whole range of issues. But I have a real difference of opinion with Senator Kerry. I led the effort in the House in challenging the Bush administration's march towards war. Senator Kerry said there were weapons of mass destruction. He voted for the war. He supports the occupation, has said that he's going to send more troops abroad for the United States. I mean, we have to give the people a real choice.
Kucinich says he plans to stay in the race until the Democratic convention. As the battle for the White House wages on, exit polls showed that voters were overwhelmingly concerned with a variety of issues, but it was jobs and the economy that topped the list for the majority of voters. Other issues on the minds of voters included trade, health care, the war in Iraq, and gay marriage. In addition, young voters mentioned concern with job security and the rising cost of higher education. In a landmark local election in California, Mendocino became the first county in the nation to ban genetically engineered crops and animals. Former California Congressman Dan Hamburg is the advisor to the Yes on Measure H campaign. He says voters were able to pass Measure H in spite of being outspent.
The best read we have on their total expenditure was that it was about $620,000. And to put that in perspective, Mendocino County has 47,000 registered voters, of which maybe 60% voted. Our calculations are that they spent somewhere between $40 and $50 per vote.
Super Tuesday also represented the first large-scale test of electronic voting, and by many accounts, the electronic voting machines failed. Malfunctions were reported in Georgia, Maryland, and California. Some states purchased machines that would not provide a printed record, a particularly important issue if a recount were required.
One of the questions that citizens have been asking all day in Maryland is, are these electronic voting machines counting our votes, or are they eating them? Because once machines crash, votes are absolutely lost.
In addition to faulty machines, Georgia's former Democratic Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney says crossover voting, in which significant Republicans and independents can vote in a Democratic primary and sway election results, was another problem.
It is very clear that the Democratic Party is going to have to do something about this phenomenon of open primaries, where Republicans have the opportunity to come in at the last minute and just kind of muck things up.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gail Walker.
For the second time in 6 months, Republican members of Congress called a hearing to discuss the possibility of creating a new amendment to the Constitution to define marriage as between one man and one woman only. Voices from all sides of the debate were on Capitol Hill today to express their sentiments on the matter, and all had strong personal feelings about the evolving institution of marriage. Jenny Johnson files this report from our D.C. Bureau.
Senate members and guests criticized the focus on a constitutional redefinition of marriage when people are overwhelmingly more concerned about the high cost of health care, loss of jobs to outsourcing overseas, and loved ones being sent to an increasingly dangerous war in Iraq. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin said he regarded this discussion as a distraction from pressing problems and described it as the use of the Constitution for political purposes.
The president supports a constitutional amendment. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee says he's going to force an amendment through the committee. And the chairman of the Republican Conference said this weekend that there will be a vote on the Senate floor on the amendment this year. Yet few believe that this effort will be successful. This, unfortunately and sadly, is a divisive political exercise in an election year, plain and simple.
More, however, was at stake for those who support an amendment in order to protect marriage. Judges and lawyers who support opening up marriage laws to same-sex partners were blamed for creating the need to take marriage to the Constitution for permanent federal definition. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas, who is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee, calls this an historically significant issue.
The only reason that we are having this issue, this hearing today, is because of the work of aggressive lawyers and a handful of accommodating activist judges. The union of mother and father is the optimal, most stable foundation for the family and for raising children.
In a room full of non-traditional parents holding their children, some raised the old argument that children raised by gay and lesbian parents could be hurt by that arrangement. Reverend Richard W. Richardson is a minister of the African Methodist Episcopal Church of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and president of a child services agency.
Children are raised expecting to have a biological mother and father in their life. It is basic human instinct. Marriage is about children, not about love.
The more recent history of discrimination in the United States was used to bring the case of the civil rights organization, the NAACP. National Representative Hillary Shelton expressed the group's opposition to the proposed marriage amendment.
The federal marriage amendment would, for the first time, use the amendment to the Constitution as a tool of exclusion. It is so extreme that in addition to prohibiting any state government from honoring domestic contractual agreements between persons of the same gender in their states, it would also bar state and local governments from providing basic protections of citizens of the same gender and their families. Even such fundamental protections as hospital visitation, inheritance rights, predetermined child custody rights, and health care benefits.
Donna Victoria Gonzalez, part of a group of young people visiting the Capitol from San Francisco, expressed the need to allow marriage to evolve according to the choices of contemporary culture.
They're just staying stuck in the past.
We need to go forward. We can't just stay here.
Another step in history.
Exactly.
Because there's always something that needs to be overcome, and this is the next issue that's being brought up.
Debate will continue as the complex process of amending the Constitution proceeds. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
UN arms inspector said on Tuesday that the United States has hampered efforts to completely account for Iraqi weapons. This after the same report confirmed Iraqi's chemical and biological weapons were destroyed largely before 1994. The Iraqi Governing Council announced it will formally sign a U.S.-approved Iraqi constitution on Friday. As a U.S. military spokesperson told reporters in Baghdad today, 15 people have been arrested in connection with yesterday's bombings in Iraq that left more than 250 dead. 9 suspects are being held by Iraqi police, and 6 are in the custody of the U.S.-led military. Meanwhile, the Al-Qaeda organization, which American officials say organized attacks, told a London-based newspaper, Al-Quds Al-Arabiya, they had nothing to do with them. As Aaron Glantz reports from the Iraqi city of Kirkuk, most Iraqis are skeptical of the American authorities.
It's quiet on the streets of a Shiite slum on the outskirts of Kirkuk. A few children play on an old wooden crate in front of a fruit stand. The attacks in Baghdad and Karbala are on everyone's minds, along with the crushing poverty of their current situation. Shopkeeper Ali Adnan Adwan thinks the attacks and the poverty are connected. He graduated law school a few months before last year's war, but with limited telephone service and intermittent electricity, it's hard to run a law practice, so he started a fruit stand.
The people who don't have jobs will go to anyone with money to explode themselves. For example, a taxi driver told me someone will pay $250,000 to people who explode themselves so their family and their grandchildren will be able to live well in the future. This is the result of the poverty.
While the Bush administration and the Iranian government blame Al-Qaeda for the blast, many Shiites here in Iraq see an American role. Muftar al-Hassan Romanthe is a follower of Iraq's young firebrand, Ayatollah Muqtar al-Sadr.
They encourage these bombings in order to be sure they'll be able to stay here for a long time. The bombings yesterday were timed with signing the new constitution in Baghdad, and they want to postpone these steps. When these steps finish, they will have to leave this area. And for this reason, they're encouraging this terrorism. And they let them do what they want in order to prevent this area from becoming stable and safe.
The Eid attacks on Baghdad and Najaf mark the third time major political or religious activities have been bombed since the American army took over from Saddam Hussein. Speaking on Al Arabiya television, Lebanese Ayatollah Hassan Fatlallah said it's no accident a Shiite religious festival was targeted while Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani was calling for elections.
We cannot prove that America has participated in these explosions, but I don't think it's Zarqawi or Al-Qaeda. We know that the Americans are treating our people very badly. They have to leave immediately, and the CIA has to know that they cannot put the Shia in a place to fight Sunni.
4 o'clock in Kirkuk, and the U.S. military is performing a regular search of the local Communist Party offices. A dozen American soldiers with machine guns and body armor are searching the building, while another dozen station themselves outside, some allowing Iraqi children to play with their automatic weapons. The commanding officer, Lieutenant Frazi, says his troops found 5 Kalashnikovs, the self-defense limit set by American authorities. Lieutenant Frazi says his troops will continue regularly searching the offices of all of Kirkuk's political parties. He'll be searching the Communists' office again within the next 2 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Kirkuk, Iraq.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley, California, and WBAI in New York City. I'm Jackson Allers.